And we're live on the Commercial Real Estate Playbook. Frank, how are you doing this morning?
Doing good. It's good to get the band back together. We haven't done an episode together in a few weeks, and we're joined by a cool dude, fellow storage operator. That's one of the businesses he runs, but Carl Graham. How are you doing, Carl? Nice to have you on.
Hey, guys. Yeah, pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. Enjoying the end of summer here and excited to be here.
For sure. We're excited to talk to you. Let's first just give a quick overview of kind of who you are in a business sense, and then we'll kind of get into who you are behind the business.
Yeah. So presently we founded Illuminus Capital as kind of a experiment in 2020. We currently own and operate 14 storage facilities, mostly here in Oklahoma, where I live. I live in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I grew up, and it's 14 facilities, about 3,200 actual units, doors, if you will, and about 500,000 square feet. So we acquired all that since January 1st, basically, of 2021. My background prior to that experiment, I was a geologist and engineer in the oil and gas industry. And so I did that for the previous 12 years. Worked for a big multinational company and then also helped found a private equity backed oil and gas company. And it's been a pretty, I never expected to be here. If you asked me 5 years ago if I'd be doing what I'm doing now, I would have laughed and never believed you. So it's been a really fun transformation, and we invest in oil and gas as well. And that's been a fun, it's been fun to be able to get back into that sandbox. But I spend most of my time on real estate now.
I got to ask. So, that transition, you're doing oil and gas for 12 years. At that point, you're probably somewhat of an expert. You've attained all this knowledge. What prompted you to make that jump into real estate, yeah, self-storage in your case?
Well, it was really an accident. Truly, what happened was we were kind of in the ninth inning of our business plan for the oil and gas business that we had. And really, we were working towards selling it. It would have been the natural exit for that business. And then COVID happened March of 2020. Oil prices tanked. The capital markets totally shut down. And, you know, the likelihood of selling, and, you know, we basically just went backwards in the business plan a lot of time. And so that created a lot of, we weren't doing, the business activity was very low, basically, and we had a lot of spare time once we got things stabilized. And my partner and I, we were partners in that business then as well. And he kept bringing up real estate as something maybe we could do. We were kind of already thinking about what's next. And I really didn't want to do real estate. It always sounded boring to me. I'd explored it a little bit earlier in my career, kind of single family homes and that sort of thing, and just never really appealed to me. But anyways, kept the dialogue going, and eventually we kind of discovered that there's a few real estate assets like storage, which actually have a pretty heavy operational component to them. So it's really, I think of it as, you know, a real asset with wrapped in an operating business. And that actually got me more excited. I like operations. I like people, processes, strategy, all those things. And basically storage was one of the three assets that we realized we could take a bite-sized piece off of, you know, during this kind of slow period in our other business, and not need to hire a bunch of people, not need to, you know, drop everything else that we're doing. We can still take a bite, see if we like it, and go from there. And that's what we did. We found our first and our second assets about the same. They closed about the same time in January. And then the snowball just kept rolling. I had spent a lot of time and effort working on trying to raise some capital and start another oil and gas business, because it was kind of the right time, blood on the streets, you know, but it was just an uphill battle. I was, you know, burning the midnight oil for weeks.
Is that because people were less interested or scared of oil and gas at the time?
Generally the industry has suffered from a lack of capital and lack of general interest. But it was really just because it's ironic, but you know, just like in real estate, I think the perfect time to buy properties is usually when there's no capital, there's no liquidity. People are going to hang on to their assets with an iron grip, you know, because they don't want to lose. It's the same in oil and gas. When oil price tanks, everyone just goes into, you know, protection mode, basically just trying to survive. And you assume you can go get really great deals then because people are hurting. But the truth is, there's not going to be much capital to actually buy it. So that was a lot of it. It's also just a very difficult business, and it's a very risky business. You know, mm-hmm. in general, it's very cyclical. There's a lot of things you don't control, and so it's a difficult business to raise money in. Total opposite of storage. So we started this little experiment, right? And it wasn't no effort, but with, you know, a modest amount of effort, things just kept going. We weren't fighting. I didn't feel like I was swimming upstream anymore. And so that kind of clicked, and I was like, you know, like there's easier games to play in the world. And this seems like one of them. So let's do this. And I basically made a commitment. I'll do this for 6 months. If we don't reach this goal that I set for us, then I'll just go back. But if we hit that goal, then I'll just keep my head down and we'll keep doing this. And, the environment was good. You know, we got lucky with timing and we were able to keep going and, get to a scale that allowed me to kind of not look backwards anymore. And so really thankful for that, but I never intended to leave. And I honestly was, people would ask me like, oh, we lost another good one, you know, because typically in downturns in oil and gas, just like any cyclic industry, you lose a lot of talent during those troughs mm-hmm. because they lose their job or they get sick of the cyclicity and the insecurity and they leave and go find something else more stable. And I really didn't have any intention of doing that. I love the energy industry, but it's too good a thing to pass up in this real estate boom. So.
So you hit the ground running, you got a great portfolio. And if your deal flow has been anything like ours, deal flow has decreased, right? It's harder to find good deals. So talk me through what your business is looking like at a day-to-day now. And also, do you have an eye back on oil and gas at all? As we, you know, see a little bit of a slowdown in real estate.
Yeah. I mean, right now our day-to-day deal flow is, we see there's plenty of things that, you know, for sale. But there's a pretty big spread and I don't really see it contracting that much between what sellers would like to sell for and what buyers would like to buy for. We have one property actually listed for sale. We were kind of testing the market with, it was one where there's an opportunity to get maybe an easy single, take some risk off the table. But so I'm on both sides right now, so I can kind of feel for both parties, I guess. But right now we've spent the most of the second quarter working on our processes and our people and focusing on our operations, which we've always had a focus on, but onboarded some new tools, tried to streamline some things that we realized we weren't that great at. And that's starting to pay off. That's like I mentioned to you guys, my wife and I had a baby in June, and much of our streamlining had kind of been finished by then. And that my day-to-day is helping make decisions, helping deal with big problems if they come up. But overall, I'm trying to really lean on the team and let them execute. And that's a lot of it right now. With the slowdown, obviously that if your business is going well, then you should create a little bit of time to spend on something else. And last fall, when kind of that gap in buy and seller and buyer spread, when that happened in the fall, I was just beating my head against the wall. It felt like just getting punched in the face, you know, just making tons of offers, not going anywhere. And I took a moment, actually, a guy that I really, really like and have a lot of respect for, but real estate god on Twitter, he posted this, a positioning exercise, something kind of talked about that. And it's essentially looking at your current position, your current resources, and kind of the environment and making sure your position is right and your sources of leverage. Those are the three, you know, position, resources, and sources of leverage, and seeing if you need to reposition yourself and what you're doing, spending your time on. I did that exercise in the fall and realized, you know, I have this huge network of and talent in oil and gas space that I'm not using at all. So that's a source of leverage I wasn't using at all. And I have a big network in that space, but I also have some new resources. I have investors that I've made money, you know, done well for. And I have a team of people that can do all sorts of things behind me that I didn't have before. So I repositioned myself and spent some time back in the oil and gas space starting last fall and really first and second quarter this year. And we started up a new strategy where we invest in oil and gas directly. There's a lot of really interesting things in the space, but what basically we're able to do is buy a JV interest in oil wells. And so it's a passive interest. We don't have employees doing anything out in the field. We just have a percentage interest in the project heads up with, and then there's another company that we essentially are partnering with, who does all the work and then basically bills us for that management. So that's been fun, and we're looking to grow that. I think the time is good for it. And that'll give us something else to, you know, another arrow in our quiver, something else we can offer our investors, and again, applying leverage where we have resources. And so I am keen to get back into that space. It's really, it's fun and exciting. It's very cyclic. It's also a lot of really great people. A lot of like the oil and gas industry attracts very, very talented, intelligent, and very hardworking and competitive people, because that's what it takes. And so I do enjoy, you know, working with all those people.
Which one do you like better? If you have to do work on one thing the rest of your life and it was oil and gas or storage, what would you pick?
Honestly, probably storage, because I don't work for fun, really. But you can control more. Well, let me rephrase that. You can bet on yourself easier in real estate in general, but in storage, you know, that's our thing. Oil and gas, for example, you can do all the right things, make great decisions. And then Saudi Arabia can wake up and decide they want the oil price to be, you know, 30% lower, and you just lost.
Yeah.
You lost the game.
Yeah.
Dejecting when you really just, you know, pour yourself into something and then really have no control over the outcome, just how it feels. I mean, maybe a little bit, but it's pretty dejecting. And I think in storage specifically, we've been able to apply the exact same kind of discipline and rigor that we would put towards underwriting an oil and gas project. We just put the exact same rigor and, you know, effort into a real estate project. And I think the range of outcomes is much narrower in storage. And that feels good.
Yeah. They're both commodities, but one has like way more volatile supply. Like storage supply is actually more volatile than other real estate asset classes, I would argue, mm-hmm. but like not like oil, you know, oil's like yeah. different ballgame.
Well, there's a much smaller universe that you have to worry about. Like when you own a storage facility, you know, I can't remember the exact numbers, but it's like 60, 70%, maybe more of the demand comes from within 3 miles. Mm-hmm. So like your world, your universe for that investment is like a 3 mile concern. Mm-hmm. You know, where if you drill an oil well, you have to worry about oil's fungible. You know, so the supply can come, it's global.
Yeah.
Russia could discover some huge new field and flood the market with supply. And there's nothing you can do about that. Supply is the one risk in storage that we worry about and that we can't control, too much, but you can at least defend it a little bit.
Or what are some of those misconceptions you had coming into storage, or maybe the average person had or has? I'll give one to start. Is we thought the ability to lose the 40-hour payroll person was going to be a huge competitive advantage. Ultimately, we find that we still need boots on the ground. And although we have a call center, we can save some on payroll, but it's not nearly the giant NOI lever that we kind of thought it would be. Mm-hmm. What are some of those misconceptions with storage?
Well, I agree with what you just said. To me, the biggest misconception I hear over and over is that this is a passive, you know, cash cow. Like, that's what I hear all the time. It must be so easy. And just metal boxes, you don't have people living there, et cetera. But clearly, to do well, especially in a competitive environment like we've had, I mean, you've got to push and pull, you know, turn everything up to 10 to really perform. And that takes a lot of work, a lot of effort. You know, when you push rent, when you push rents and are actively doing revenue management, you're creating customer churn. And every time a customer moves out, you got to replace them. There's work that happens at the facility. You got to make the unit ready. They leave trash behind. You know, people go delinquent more when you're pushing. You have more customer service effort because they're calling to complain about this and that. If they're charging, they're paying the highest in the market in rent, they're going to not let anything slide, you know? So to do it right, it takes a lot more effort than I think most people realize. And there's expenses involved too. And that's just, I think, the biggest misconception I see. I look at real estate assets kind of, because I like the operational aspect, I like to think about how many tenants do you have per dollar of like capital, like acquisition capital, you know? So like a house, 250K, you got one customer. Apartments, you know, $100,000 unit, you got one customer. Well, in storage, you know, you might pay $8,000 a unit. So it's like 10 times as many customers per dollar of capital that you're deploying. And the tenancy is short, you know, it's a shorter length tenancy as well. So, it's operational business at the end of the day.
I agree. I think a lot of the misconception comes from many years of high occupancy and increasing rates. So like you kind of don't have to spend the same amount on marketing and there's less customer churn because they have nowhere else to go. And now we're seeing that in a falling rental rate environment and a falling occupancy environment, you know, your revenue might stay more flat. We're still increasing our revenue, but it's not at the same growth it was a year ago.
Yeah.
But our OPEX and like our op tempo feels much faster because our occupancy, instead of being a 93% or greater, is like in the 80s and in some cases in the 70s. So you got to go to work, you know? So I think that new reality is really highlighting that, that misconception. So I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of related, but I'll share it because I think it, I'm curious if you guys think of it similarly, but we basically are trying to buy storage facilities that have from owners who are running them on easy mode. You know, I think there's two ways to operate a storage facility. You can operate it as a lifestyle business. You know, if you live in town and you got some cash and you built a facility 20 years ago, you're probably been running it on easy mode. Like, what's the easiest, least amount of work I can do to make $80,000 of cash flow a year? You know, well, I want it to be full, so I'm not answering the phones on Saturdays. So I'm going to charge low rent. I'm not going to charge fees. I'm not going to jerk people around. You know, and there's nothing wrong with that. Like that's the operator's choice. And if they can afford to run it that way, they often do. But then we try to buy it from that. And then we run the business on expert mode. Just everything's harder, you know, like we're going to charge more rents. We're going to answer the phone on 7 days a week, you know, 12 hours a day. We're going to text customers and email customers, and we're going to run Google ads, and we're going to do, you know, all these other things that you have to do in order to get that higher revenue. But it's no longer a lifestyle business. It's a, you know, fully functioning operational business. where you know, you've got pricing, marketing, customer service, all these kind of functions that don't really exist if you just run it on easy mode. And it's been easy to run it on easy mode, like to your point, Frank, the last 10 years.
Yeah. If everyone's pricing everybody out, they can't move. Right. So here's a question, Carl. I'm the seller and I'm on easy mode. Like you just said, I'm not extracting all the value I can, but I'm happy because I built this thing. So my basis is really low. So I got equity for sure. Mm-hmm. Why don't I just hire a third party manager?
Well, I think historically, you know, just to add some context, I think you and I think y'all and us pursue similar size assets, you know, sub-institutional maybe, at least historically sub-institutional, 20 to 50,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. And in markets, not necessarily like the highest rent markets in the country for sure. And so I think historically there just weren't many third party options. There weren't many people you could hire to do that. Your choice was really to hire a person, you know, to do it all. And you really couldn't afford to pay that person very much. You know, so you were looking at someone who maybe is not super motivated, or maybe it's a side job for them. So I don't think historically there were good options. I think there's more options today than there were the previous 5-10 years. So that's, I think, one answer. The other answer is, I think a lot of the storage owners that I talk to, you know, that we might want to buy from, a lot of them, at least here in kind of the flyover country, they're kind of, their personality is such that they built this facility because they wanted to have their own thing, and you know, they do their own thing. And I think the idea of having some third party run your asset for you doesn't sit well with a lot of them. A lot of them are, you know, old school, for lack of a better word. I don't really know how to, nothing mm-hmm. bad about it, but they've just been doing something one way for 20 years. And, the last thing that's the most important reason they wouldn't do that right now, or over the last couple of years, I think, is because the market would pay them for all that upside, most of that upside anyways, so if they wanted to sell the last 2 years. So they're really like, I mean, they really had it good if they sold, because, you know, if there was tons of upside in 2021, they were getting paid for most of it.
Yeah. And lenders will lend on more like pro forma aggressive underwriting. Yeah. Whereas now they don't want to do that probably at all. So buyers could also maybe get away with it. I'm not saying it's good underwriting all the time, but they could get away with it for sure.
They could. Yeah. And a lot of them did. So when we started looking at storage in like summer of 2020, we were kind of doing our kind of primary research. I feel like we were just barely getting to see what the storage market had been like for the previous 5 years or so, like what deals looked like, you know, what underwriting was like. And we were able to see between now and then, I think we've seen basically almost a full cycle. So I feel pretty fortunate that we got to see what that was like. I don't know if it'll ever be like that again. I sort of doubt it. And there's too much capital's flowed in. Stories, you know, it's in the Wall Street Journal, you know, multiple Wall Street Journal articles, and that's enough, I think, to keep it from going back to the way it was. But it was interesting to be able to see that and compare and see the contrast between that and last year, you know, or 2021.
I think that I talk about that with John all the time, about how like this whipsaw economy is like this just mega compressed cycle that we went through, and we're kind of on like a down cycle. But it's happening so fast because of how much we've manipulated rates too.
Yeah.
Like when we started, we bought in Oklahoma too. So our first two facilities were in Oklahoma. And in 2021, you can go on market on LoopNet and pick up like a 7.5 cap in Oklahoma over 25,000 square feet and just buy it like at the beginning. But then as interest rates stayed low, like that just is not happening anymore, at least in our experience. Like I'm not seeing it. But we're getting back there. I feel like we're getting back there, albeit slowly. It's crazy how much it changed.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that happened and that we watched happen is historically, you know, there was a pretty big spread between, you know, cap rates for tertiary, secondary, primary markets and regionally as well. And we just watched all those cap rates just all compress and normalize, you know, where there was really no extra risk priced in, you know, a suburb, a 50,000 person town in Oklahoma versus DFW. Like this,
yeah,
the spread between those two cap rates is very small. Whereas historically it might've been, you know, a 10 cap versus a 7 cap. Well, now it's like a 4.7 cap versus a 5.5 cap or something like that. And it's,
yeah. I think honestly, that's probably pretty right on. I think 10 caps maybe were hard to find, but I think you're pretty close.
Yeah. I mean, there's, yeah, today, I don't know, but that was the difference. You could see that different. There was a much bigger spread historically. I think basically the capitals realized that really the demand for storage is pretty agnostic to geography. Like the only difference between those two markets really is just the rent. And so not necessarily the risk though. Maybe the risk, I think there is more risk in smaller markets because of more chances of increased supply. And I think that risk is probably mispriced a lot of places right now. I think most people are perceiving that risk in all these smaller markets is still low, but I think it's probably not.
Yeah. It's like in the really rural stuff with lots of available dirt, it's almost like the storage buyers trying to eat the mom and pop. Like, hey, I'm going to take your facility. I'm going to buy it for $3 million, make it worth five or six. But then they're just going to get eaten up by another mom and pop doing the exact same thing, just building it, like buying land for $20,000 and putting up 20,000 square feet. And then now the mom and pop eats the private equity guy. I think like there's going to be a lot of that going on.
Could be. Yeah. I mean, I know some people here in Oklahoma that can build a storage facility for pretty low dollar per square foot. And part of it's because they do a lot themselves.
Yeah.
So their math is totally different from your math and my math, you know? And the other truth is they may not open up Excel before they choose to do it. Like they just decide to do it. I've seen that. I've had that conversation. And so that's what scares me the most. Is that anyone who's got, you know, has a couple hundred grand and they're in a decent relationship with the local bank can go build a new facility.
Every single qualified lead I've talked to in the Midwest recently is a developer who built their own stuff and they own 2 to 3 facilities. Like that is exactly who you're talking about. Go ahead. Sorry, Plum, go ahead.
What's your crystal ball tell you, Carl? Right? Give me a 6-12 month maybe, and then maybe a little longer term. What's the crystal ball say?
I try to avoid these questions.
Of course, it makes for good podcasts, though.
It's fun to try, though. Yeah, I think the Federal Reserve is going to get what they want, and they're not going to just fold until they do. So, I think the consumer is going to weaken some. I think interest rates are going to stay where they're at for a little while. And I think we're going to keep trying to find storage facilities and have a really hard time. I don't know, that kind of covers a lot of the bases. It will be interesting to see what the credit markets are like in a year. I mean, I'm hearing about a little distress here and there, but it's mostly not in the storage space. It's mostly seems to be in obviously office, but also multifamily. A lot of the multifamily deals, the guys that I talk to or read about, it seems to be there. There's some legit, you know, distress there if things weren't financed properly. But has that addressed? Is that what other things we want to guess about?
I think long term, do you remain bullish on storage? Right, like short term, we've got a cycle, you know, as we look at square foot per capita or just like the demand of storage across the country, do you think that's going to be remain relatively steady, or do you see any change in that? Are you a bull on storage long term?
I think, yeah, I would say all of our partnerships and all of our business plans basically are premised on our comfort with that asset for a long time. I mean, we've acquired the properties and built the machine to run the properties such that we can do it for a long time. We could have flipped and made a bunch of profit if we weren't bullish long term. But now that said, I'm not so bullish that I'm out building, adding a bunch of new supply right now. At what I think is probably a high basis and really high cost of capital. And I reserve the right to change my mind.
Yeah.
You know, I think if there's any signal to suggest otherwise, but the truth is it's really market dependent. I think there are markets we're in where the demand is still very high, and you know, I'm not worried about even some new supply. It wouldn't really bother me at all. And there's other markets where it's clearly softened a lot and, you know, less bullish in that market, I guess I'd say. So I think that's true. I mean, it's a microeconomic and micro local supply and demand business. And so I try to caveat most of my worries and projections with, you know, it really is a local market. So.
Very good. Let's switch gears a little bit. Now let's talk about family. I think we counted it up before we started recording and we've got like 37, 40 kids between the three of us, something like that. But let's introduce us to your family, and then, you know, how do you think about balancing that ambition of being an entrepreneur, maybe the ego associated with that, and also being a great dad, a great husband? How do you try to balance all that?
Yeah. I think one of the surprises for me is in this whole kind of new venture is how different my life is now than it was when I worked, you know, when I was aspiring to be an executive at a big, you know, big company. My wife and I, we just had our sixth child in June. We've been married 12 years, and my oldest is 11. So we had about 1 year of married life with no kids. And we were pretty young then. So, you know, being a parent has been, I've been a parent most of my adult life, basically. It's a constant struggle. I wouldn't say I'm a great parent. But I think time will tell, I guess, once the kids mature a little bit more, but, it's a huge part of our life. And it's the last 2 years and the last two children that our youngest children, I mean, they're getting to spend so much more time with me, which I just think kids spending time with their fathers is, I think it's huge. It's super impactful in their lives. I think there's a lot of evidence for that. But I mean, real estate and what we do, our new business, my new work has been a total game changer in my ability to really help at home and just be present. So that's the biggest change, I would say. And it's parenting is a constant struggle, but yeah. I'm curious for you guys. I mean, you guys were both in the military, so I had the benefit of getting to live in San Antonio once. Most of my neighbors were all military families, and those were the best neighbors we had. We really loved our time there. But how is it? I mean, your lives probably have changed quite a bit since the military, since changing careers. So is it similarly different though, or?
Yeah, I would say for me, I'm present quite a bit more in the military. Like being a husband and being a dad, unfortunately, has to take second seat a lot of the time, right? So the amount of hours you work is one thing, but the other thing is just that you basically have to be ready to go into work and take care of business and stay late, show up early. Hey, your weekend's gone. Hey, your you know, you're going to do some training in a different state for 2 weeks next month, last minute, you get a lot of that. So unfortunately, you're just not able to be as present, right? And then there was a certain extent, towards the end of my time in the military, I didn't find it as stimulating and intellectually engaging. Therefore, I could tend to kind of be in a bad mood, even if I wasn't at work, right? So aspect now, as I look at entrepreneurship, you know, generally I'm home and present a lot more. But the other thing is I feel much more fulfilled in the work that I'm doing. So hopefully that leads to me being a better parent and a better husband. What about you, Frank? What do you think?
I didn't have kids while in the military. I had my kids a couple of years after I got out. So I can't like make a direct comparison for myself. But like going back to just real estate and like how that translates to being a dad, I find that because we have flexible schedules and like, honestly, if there's no deals going on and our ops team's handling everything, like you do have free time. I think the biggest challenge when you work on deals is when deal flow is low and you get frustrated, like staying present psychologically and not being frustrated with work, right? I think that that's my current challenge. I think if you can overcome that, I think real estate is an amazing business to be a great dad, right? Because you have flexibility of your schedule. You're doing fulfilling work. You're setting a good example because there's some entrepreneurial stuff your kids can take away from what you're doing. And I think all this stuff's really, really important. But I can't make the direct comparison to the military, unfortunately.
Yeah. One thing I've been thinking about is like my oldest, I think kind of know like this transition kind of happened in a weird time for me. It was during COVID when I kind of everything was weird and different and changing. But I mean, I don't think my kids don't ever opine or like, you know, really say anything about how different it is and that they like it, that it's better or worse or anything like that. They just, like, I think if I want to go home and ask him like right now, like, do you like my dad's, you know, do you like daddy's new job or his old job? You know, I'm really curious and I've never thought to ask him, but, I think they really like it. I hope that's the answer anyways.
What do you think about, a lot of people are like, hey, take all the risk before you have kids and a family, right?
Yeah.
And clearly all three of us assumed a certain amount of risk, career changes after we had already started the family. So, you know, what do you think when you see that advice?
Yeah, that's a great point. I speak up about that to some people a lot of times because I think what you need to be taking is measured risks. I agree. It would have been less risky for me to do everything I've done before I had kids. But what I don't like, what I push up against people is if they're postponing children to take a bunch of risks. Because I don't think there's ever a perfect time. It's like, there's never a perfect time to get married. There's never a perfect time to have kids. There's never a perfect time to go start a new business. I think some of the, you know, you can be adequately prepared and then that's pretty much good enough. Like if, you know, if you've got good support, good community, you're mentally prepared, you're financially prepared, you can do all three. You could do any one of those three things at a time if you wanted. You know, I think as long as you've got a sound head on your shoulders and you have those things, then I think it's a good measured risk, but you need to be prepared, you know? And that's what I did. I mean, I had a very good job right out of college. And so, my wife and I lived frugally and we were able to save a lot of money, during my professional career. And I went to business school. That was a purposeful thing to give me more optionality, more career opportunities, bigger network across a much larger geography. Like it was a very calculated thing for me in anticipation of wanting to go take more risk and also to kind of hedge the exposure I had to a very cyclic industry, the oil and gas industry. So I think everyone's path is different. And the risk everyone can tolerate is a little bit different, but you can be calculated about it and address the biggest risks that you have. That's what I've tried to do. And I don't think my family's worse off for it. You know, I think it's adds having kids adds some reality to life, you know, like some real incentive, I guess, if you will, if you take it seriously, which I think can be good.
I think it can be. Go ahead, Frank.
I was going to say, I think like people talk about this a lot, like how much of a motivator kids are. I think a lot of the best workers and most motivated people I know are parents for a good reason, right? Like you just care about your kids. But I think what is really difficult to measure and it's hard to say how valuable it is our kids watching us take risk. Like my kids are only 3 and 5, so they don't really understand what's going on. But if my kids are 10 and 11 and they see my wife and I still pushing, like what is the value of them seeing that? I don't know if anyone really knows the answer to that, but like I'm a firm believer that I don't want my kids catching me playing defense with my life or my career. So I want my kids to wake up and be like, yeah, my dad, like he's out there doing it. You know, he's not scared to do stuff. And I think I want to pass that along. And I don't know how valuable that is, or if taking too much risk could eventually sink the ship, because it could. Real estate people go broke. My family went broke when I was 8. But I still want to do it. I think it matters.
Yeah. I appreciate that, like my kids can be a little bit involved. I read about some of the older, I guess some of the guys that have been in this game a little longer, kids are older maybe, and you know, they have the desire to involve, like specifically to involve their children in the business, or maybe for the purposes of, you know, to pass the assets on to them even. I don't really spend too much time thinking about that, but I think it's something that's actually possible in real estate. When it's, you know, if you own an oil and gas business, I'll just use that because it's what I know. If you have an oil and gas business and your son or daughter does not go learn very specific things in college, it's like, it's not necessarily something you can just pass down. Like you gotta be raised up through the business and learn a lot of stuff before you could, I think, be competent to run a, you know, sizable oil and gas business. But if you got handed a portfolio of buildings, there's third party managers out there, there's, you know, established lenders, it's a lot different thing. I think that's unique about real estate too, for just for families and for wealth in general. And I think it's no coincidence that a huge amount of the real estate in this country is owned by families, and families that have been wealthy for numerous generations. A lot of them are families that originally made their wealth in oil and gas, actually. So I think the evidence is strong that it's a good store of wealth for families.
Very good. Let's go ahead and start wrapping up. But where are you going from here? What are some of those goals on your horizon, Carl?
I have a long-standing itch that really to really start or own more of a service business, like more of a people business. A lot of people, including store, like I like not having to be reliant on a lot of employees to run our store portfolio, but I haven't scratched that. So I think we're going to start a service business here soon. It's something I just wanted to do. I want to be more impactful, like just locally with people. Like maybe it's a little bit altruistic, but I really do get motivated by helping people and building things and solving problems. And so I think we're going to use some of our time now to do that here. And I think we're going to continue to push the oil and gas investment strategy. And we've got some investments there right now that we're going to be realizing here pretty soon. And there's some infrastructure we need to build out around there. So that'll definitely be something that we're focused on. And I've not been very good, except for our very initial kind of starting. I've not been very good about setting specific goals. I think I read, and I think you guys are very good about that. And so that's something I need to do probably, but
there's goods and bads though. I think Frank and I are really good at setting goals, but we also, we get punched in the face a lot, right? Cause the market gets a vote and the market gets a big vote. So, we're really good at setting goals. We're really good at getting stuff done, but ultimately we've fallen short of a bunch of our goals just because we got to acknowledge, hey, the market gets a vote, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Acquisitions based goals are tough for that reason.
Yeah, we've avoided those except for that first 6 months. That was kind of the only time I used, you know, it was like, if I haven't gotten to here, then I just need to, I'll just pull a ripcord. But I had a thought and I lost it.
That's all good.
All good. Hey, Carl, where can people find you and learn more about you?
Yeah. So our website is luminouscapital.com. There's a contact form there. My email is carl@luminouscapital.com. And on Twitter, my handle is @carlluminous, I think. But yeah, you can find me there just with my name. That's the best way.
Awesome. Well, we really appreciate you coming on, sharing some wisdom. It's nice to talk to another dad. You know, people call me crazy for having 4 kids, having 6 kids. I'm sure you get jokes all the time, but I'm proud of you, man. That's good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. People, when we told them I had 5, they kind of look at you crazy. When you say 6, it really hits different, I guess. Like, really are just mind blown, but yeah, it's a good, season of life.
I always joke that with 4 kids, you need like, you know, the biggest car they offer. With 6 kids, you need a special car, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I've been waiting for ours to arrive for over a year now. So,
oh man, that's tough.
We went from something that we wanted to something we need.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, good stuff. Really appreciate your time. Carl, Frank, take us away.
No, thank you, Carl, for coming on. This is a great conversation. We'll see everybody next week. Peace.